work him in Moscow, where the American dollar buys 7 rubles. 12 rubles. 60 rubles.
1,000 rubles! I must go!
La la la, la la la.
Ryan Dixon and Rory Boylan host Tape to Tape, the hockey podcast by Sportsnet.
Segment back after a tier tie, and it will be over! The Penguins have held on here in Game 7 to win this game 2-1. And you can spit shine your shoes, Pittsburgh. The Pens are going dancing with the Lord of Lords, Lord Stanley.
The seconds are ticking down. The fans can't believe it. They're on their feet. They're celebrating. They're cheering. And now it's down to zero. And listen to this. The San Jose Sharks swarm off the bench. They're mobbing each other. They're congratulating Martin Jones, and the happiest people on the ice are Joe Thornton, Patrick Marleau, Joe Pavelski, Marc-Edouard Vlasic, and all the leaders. For the first time in history, the San Jose Sharks will advance to the Stanley Cup Final. The final score in Game 6, the Sharks 5, the Blues 2, and it's pandemonium at SAP Center.
It's the final countdown.
Welcome to Tape to Tape, T2T. It is the final countdown. I'm Ryan Dixon. I am a writer for Sportsnet magazine and Sportsnet.ca. Sitting to my left, wondering if that silly pick is going to pay off after all, it is Sportsnet's NHL senior producer, Rory Boylan.
Welcome back, Comrade Dixon.
Why, thank you. Thank you. Yes, we're going to get to the final, of course. We're going to talk to some people who cover both the San Jose Sharks and Pittsburgh Penguins. We're going to cover off what may have gone wrong with the two Final Four teams that didn't make it to the final two. But yeah, as referenced, just back from Mother Russia. Man, it was quite a excursion I took yesterday. I stayed for a week with the lovely wife for a little vacation after the World Championship. Two stops, one lost bag of luggage. I just got an email from Air France. We'll see where it is. But yeah, the World Championship, man, it's just not something that we pay, obviously, as close attention to in Canada and the U.S. I mean, I think it's changing. I do feel like there's more, I feel like players are more apt to be involved in it, whether they're trying to endear themselves to Hockey Canada because there's, let's say, a World Cup coming up. But just in general, I think Canadian players are more interested now than they were 15 years ago and going. But, you know, the thing I'll take away from the World Championship is, you know, I'm hanging out with a Danish TV crew, and they're, you know, saying with pride, you know, this is the 10th year in a row we did not get relegated. Like, this is a big deal, this tournament to European nations. And, you know, there's a team that didn't come even within a mile of a medal, but we're still really happy with the showing. And just the zaniness in the stands, the passion from the Russians, a lot of chants.
This is what I wanted to ask you about, because I have been to one World Championship game when it was here in Quebec City a few years ago, and been to a number of NHL games, obviously, over the years between Toronto and Montreal. And the World Championship game I went to in Quebec, even though it wasn't in Europe, it was on Canadian soil, it was a totally different experience than any NHL game I've ever been to in the atmosphere at the arena. I think it was Russia. It was definitely Russia, and I believe they were playing Switzerland in that game. And the fans, like, there's constant chanting, there's constant singing going on. It's a party. There's dancing. It's this whole, like, it's alive. The arena is alive. And I'm just, when you're in Europe, you're in one of these countries who cares about this tournament a lot more than Canada. I mean, what is that like? I mean, you went as a media member, but you're absorbing this. You're around all the fans too. What is it like?
Oh yeah, like I would come out of my hotel and there'd be a pack of five dudes in Swiss jerseys and like big crazy hats, all hacking a butt and getting ready to go to the arena where, you know, I saw in a super tense game that Switzerland had to win to have a crack at making the medal round. They're playing the Czech Republic. They're losing like 2-1. You know, you would think that because you have this all this huge, like, nationalistic pride going on, there'd be potential for some of the bad stuff we see in European fanhood more frequently. But instead, I look down with like 8 minutes left and I'm watching a conga line with literally like there's got to be 20 people in it, and 8 of them are from the Czech Republic. Another 6 are from Switzerland, and a handful more are from undetermined, and someone's dressed up like a cow and they're going around the rink, and it's awesome. It's just awesome. I feel like just reflecting on it now, you see all the good parts of fandom and none of the unfortunate bits where people get carried away. Like, you think when there's that much pride, sometimes it would spill into some bad stuff. But I just, you know, anecdotally having spent a week there, I didn't see any evidence of that. Even, you know, with the Russians who were like desperate to have a better showing after Sochi, and ultimately were disappointed because they didn't make the final. But still, it just seemed all very passionate, very good natured, and never veered into anything bad. So yeah, just you know, it's just a little zany for to our sensibilities, right?
Yeah.
And that's what makes it super fun.
Moscow is a big city, obviously. Did you get the feeling of that this event was going on just around the arena, or did you feel it a little bit beyond that?
So I spent most of my time during the tournament either in the hotel, on the shuttle bus to the rink, or at the rink. But, you know, around the rink, there is huge, huge outdoor areas set up with big screens for people who wanted to come watch games who couldn't even necessarily get in the rink. I'm pretty sure there was something at Red Square, because when I went during one of the off days and then actually after the tournament, it looked like they were tearing something down. So I think, you know, I definitely got the vibe coming in on the cab ride. You would go by bars with the big world championship poster. Like, I definitely think it was a happening and it was on people's radar that this had come to Moscow, and that the Russian team, because it was in St. Petersburg and Moscow, the Russian team was played its whole tournament in, right, in Moscow. So yeah, I mean, certainly around the hotel, you just go down the road to one of the knockoff German beer houses, and there'd be, you know, games on 8 screens. So yeah, there was a definite vibe.
And as far as covering the games as a media member, the differences between covering a world championship game and covering an NHL game or a junior game or something over here?
Yeah, it was my first encounter with the term mix zone. So just a little inside baseball here, but to bring people up to speed, the way it typically works here covering the NHL would be, and I think a big difference between hockey and or probably North American sports and European sports is in Europe, you don't go into the dressing room. I think that would blow the mind of media members in Europe that, oh yeah, and in North America, like if you're covering the Stanley Cup final, after the game, you probably have to make a choice. It's tough to go to both rooms. You might be able to, but you go into the Pittsburgh Penguins, or I guess the Cup final is a bad example because they'll bring people out to the podium. But typically for a hockey game, you go into a room, you know the principal characters are likely going to be made available, whoever scored the winning goal, or if someone coughed up the puck and that led to the other team winning the game, that guy's probably made available. Not really the same scene at the World Championship. There is basically a big long hallway with a barrier, and the players from both teams walk down one side, and it's reflective of the hierarchy in sports media. The first thing they come across is TV, so it's kind of like, well, there's TV commitments, and you know, there's things that you're going to have to do if, again, you're one of the principals. And then way down at the end, of course, is the lowly print guys, and basically you're just yelling at guys as they go by. Like, that was more or less it. So for, you know, in certain situations, it was like, well, you can yell, but good luck. But then sometimes, you know, a guy you think might just breeze on by would stop. And I don't think I'd spoken to Evgeny Kuznetsov before this tournament. I'd heard he was kind of a, like, affable guy with a good sense of humor. I talked to him after a couple of Russian games, you know, just for 2-3 minutes with a bunch of other reporters from different countries around. And man, he was great. He gave me my quote of the tourney. I was doing a story on Vadim Shipachev after the one of the last preliminary games. That line, him, Artemi Panarin, and Dadanov. Yeah, is it? Who plays in St. Petersburg as well. They were crazy. So I was asking about Shipachev because obviously he was the big UFA or attracting all this unrestricted free agent interest. And Kuznetsov just looks at me and goes, he's a Russian Crosby because he wears 87 too. And he grinned and I was like, yes, you're going to play this game. This is fun. It's a grab bag. You never know. Like, you do get a crack at guys from both teams. So that's good. I did a big story on Nigel Dawes, who was playing for Kazakhstan along with Brandon Bochensky and Dustin Boyd. Yeah. So I chatted.
Now that's a line that would own preseason NHL.
Absolutely. you'd lose track of these things, but those guys, those five guys have played on the same team in Astana in Kazakhstan for 5 years now. Because they played that many consecutive years in one country, they're eligible to play for that country. So Dawes, it was his first time. I don't know about Boyd and Bochensky. I think it was their first as well, but it was his first time at the Worlds. And yeah, I mean, I talked to him the day after Kazakhstan played its last game and you could tell, like, part of him was thinking, I wanted to come here for the experience. I wouldn't otherwise be able to play. But at the same time, he was invested, and you could tell he was frustrated with some of the stuff that, you know, I think that essentially the Kazakh team probably showed up with a happy-to-be-here mentality, because for those guys, they're like, we're in the big group this year. Great. Mm-hmm. Whereas he's like, I won gold with Sidney Crosby at the World Junior. Like, I didn't come here to lose 8-1, even though I knew that we were in tough, and it's tough to break out of that mindset. So yeah, I had a great long chat with him about how Kazakhstan's become home, and again, interesting insight into just the world of hockey outside the NHL and the different places it can take someone and the different life that can unfold. And he was saying, I never thought I'd be saying it, but when the plane touches down there, myself and my wife and now our young boy, who's only a couple months old, it's home, you know. It feels great to be there. And he's like, I was also thinking, the thing about the World Championship as it pertains to Canada is that this is actually the tournament where the best virtue of Canadian hockey should actually, and has the last couple of years, float to the surface, i.e. we always hear about Canada could put in four teams. So Canada's dominance should actually never be more on display than when you go to a team where everyone doesn't have its best players available, right? Because its pool is so much bigger. So look at Nigel Dawes. He finished second in the KHL in goals this year. I think he had 31 in like 55 games. So like, really good. KHL's second best league, maybe third best league.
Maybe third, yeah. Yep.
Any other country, you pot 31 goals in the KHL, you're probably on the first line of your country's team at the World Championship. And you know, essentially, as far as I know, he's not even going to get a sniff for Canada.
Now, do you know if Dawes played on the same line with those other North Americans on these teams? I don't know about
in the KHL. My gut is yes, but I don't know.
It's interesting that you said that they played together for, a few years there, because when I went to Yekaterinburg in 2011, I learned something I didn't know. When Russian players, I don't know if this is still the case, but when they would come up together, they would play on the same line, same defense partners. Those five-man units would stay together all the way up, the way through your development. And that's how their minor hockey works, basically, which I found really kind of interesting.
Yeah, rooted in the old Soviet system when they really did operate as
five-man units. Yeah, and I was wondering if the pro ranks work the same, if they stick with that.
Know one of the knocks on the Russian coaching is actually that they're still kind of not, like, there's so much in-game adjustments here now, and that's not necessarily. This is all, by the way, a preview, folks, for a big story on Russian hockey I'm going to write about in Sportsnet magazine. That's actually the driving force behind what I was there for. But there's still some of that old school. Tikhanov, you play the same five guys. Tikhanov came to the 87 Canada Cup, ruled four lines and six D pairs against Wayne Gretzky, Mario Lemieux, and Marc Messier, all either in the dead of their prime or about to be in their prime. And, you know, that team was an overtime goal in game two away of a best of three final from beating that Canadian team. So it shows you it was working for them and just the depth they had then. But yeah, I mean, really, it was really cool to see how into it the Russians were up close. And yeah, maybe a good segue to the teams that lost here in the conference final of the NHL, because there was, you know, definitely disappointment, but the silver lining in that they won a bronze anyways.
There was hockey going on in North America.
Yeah. It was happening just as I was going to bed at the end of a long day at 2 a.m.
Yeah. They were a great series.
Yeah.
They were a great series. Like it's a shame that, you know, the ratings are down, because it's been fantastic hockey. And I think all along there was this suggestion that, oh, wouldn't it be great if the Dallas Stars got to the Stanley Cup final, because they're this high-flying offensive team, and if they were to win, or if they were even to just get to the Stanley Cup final, other teams are going to start copying that. This is what you need to do to win now, and this would be great for the NHL. And although they didn't make it, San Jose and Pittsburgh are teams that thrive and have found success more on their offense than their defense. And, I mean, just look at Pittsburgh. Look at Pittsburgh's defense, especially now that they're without Trevor Daley. It looks like for the rest of the Stanley Cup final, although he's not ruling himself out, but I would be shocked if he came back. Their defense isn't special. San Jose's got a pretty good defense going there too, but I mean, they're not the best defensive corps in the NHL. But you look at their forwards and they're just stacked lines 1 through 4. They got a whole bunch of different kind of offensive weapons they can throw at you. I mean, San Jose started getting goals out of Jonas Donskoy and Thomas Hertl, and when you get that, I mean, you're just going to roll over everybody. And we saw some interesting, you know, decisions. It was interesting to me that St. Louis decided to go to Jake Allen halfway through their series and then ended up going back to Brian Elliott in the end. When they went to Jake Allen first in game four, they did win that game, but it wasn't because Jake Allen stole it. It was just because, I guess, the series was turning that way. San Jose wasn't gonna sweep them, although San Jose had completely outplayed St. Louis in those first three games. To me, San Jose look to be in a different class than St. Louis, which is interesting going into this offseason now, right? Yeah. Because David Backes is a UFA. You have Jake Allen, who I presume is the goalie St. Louis would prefer to run with, but Brian Elliott's the guy who just keeps awesome
playing better. Yeah.
Yeah. And the wrinkle here, of course, is both of them have expiring contracts after next season. They'll both be, well, Elliott will be a UFA, Jake Allen will be an RFA. And we have this expansion draft hanging over us. Is the NHL going to announce that? It sure sounds like something's going to happen there, and you can only protect one goalie, so you don't want to lose one of these guys for nothing. You'd rather trade them, so do you kind of get out ahead of that? And there are a number of teams that are out there looking for goalies. So again, we were talking about, you know, all playoff long, if St. Louis doesn't get over the hump this year, then they have to consider some big changes, starting with Ken Hitchcock. Well, I think Ken Hitchcock has, if he wants to stay in St. Louis, there's no reason to get rid of him. When you get to the conference final, anything can happen, right?
Partially over the hump.
Yeah. So now you're just looking at the players, and you're looking at David Backes, who had an amazing playoff for the Blues. But what do you really want to pay David Backes? Well, is this a guy who's just played himself into an overpay?
How many years do you want to pay him?
Exactly.
I think is the bigger question.
Exactly. And then Troy Brower's UFA. He had some really clutch goals for them, and they just traded TJ Oshie for him last year. So
Tough to watch him walk out the door.
Again, how much do you actually want to pay this guy? You have Jaden Schwartz, who's an RFA, so he's going to cost you a pretty penny, and he's more important, I would argue, than either of those.
Oh, certainly. Yeah,
for sure. And it was really disappointing to see Vladimir Tarasenko go scoreless, pointless in that series until the very end, when the Blues had already been defeated in that final game there, when he got on the board twice. So what do you do? What do you do with this team? Everything is there that you need. They're hard-checking. They have great scores on the rise, and they have good goaltending. To me, it's like Washington. You can't really overthink it. You can't go too far, but at the same time, you're kind of forced into a hard situation with couple key guys like Backes and Brower up as UFAs. You just can't waste that cap space.
It's a
tricky situation.
Any interesting off-season storylines in Tampa with regard to UFAs?
Steven Stamkos! He's going to Montreal, right? he came back for the final game of that series.
Game, yeah.
That was fantastic, and I think that's if I was a betting man, I think that's the last time we see him.
It's crazy
in a
how
Tampa
it really does feel that way. I'm not going to dive into it now because we've been rambling here for a while in this block, but yeah, just the whole trajectory of that Stamkos storyline from 12 months ago, you'd been like, done deal, lifetime bolt, to there was a time when I personally would say, okay, you know what, if I had to bet a nickel, truthfully, I think he's coming to Toronto, to now where I'm like, I really don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I really don't know what's going to...
Well, Elliot Friedman was reporting on one of those, I can't remember which night it was on Hockey Night in Canada, that the Rangers were open to trading Rick Nash. And if the Rangers are able to shed all or most of that cap it, you know they are in on Steven Stamkos.
Sure. Because
they'll throw money at everything. I think Philadelphia has changed a bit, but you can't rule them out. Toronto, Montreal, all those teams. And not just Steven Stamkos and how his storyline changed over the last 12 months. Less than that. Jonathan Drouin.
What if I told you back in February that Jonathan Drouin and Austin Matthews would be on the World Cup under 23 team?
I wouldn't have been totally surprised, I don't think, at Austin Matthews.
I didn't talk about him, by the way. Should I do that quick? He's if you're a Leaf fan, get excited, man. Like, he is, he's big. Like, there's like, oh, he's 6'2 and whatever. And then there's like Nick Foligno looking at him being like, he's a big dude, you know? Like,
how about to the Jets fans listeners?
Oh, 100%. 100%.
Holy cow.
But it's just fun, and I'll do it quick just because I didn't touch on it, but you know, it's just so fun that it is such apples and oranges. But I watched closely the quarterfinal game that they beat the Czechs, and that was just like a statement game. Like, Austin Matthews scored, because all tournament it was like, well, he does the little things, and then this, and you can see it, and some of you probably can't, but numbers can, and NHL players can tell you about it. But then you just see the stuff, like, okay, then there's the stuff you can't miss. Like, he comes in on a backhand, just opens up the goalie and slides in a little backhand. And then on the shootout move, he does this, like, I'm going to the backhand. Nope, just kidding. And, like, just snaps this forehand under the pad. And you're like, okay, it's not just that he's big and strong. It's that he's got serious talent, too. And then I guess it was against Canada, he cracked one in on the power play. And that game, they almost won. Just a big slap shot. Like, man, he's I mean, he is a big two-way number one center who might one day, you know, he fits the description of a team that, of a player that leads a team to the Stanley Cup final, which it's time to talk about, because we've been going on and on about all these things that aren't the Stanley Cup final. So let's make sure we do get to the main event. We're going to dial up Josh Yeo, who covers the mighty Pittsburgh Penguins. Man, speaking of, what would you say if I told you, you know, back in, let's say, November, when we were thinking maybe there'd be a fire sale in Pittsburgh? Lo and behold, here they are, back in the final after 7 years on the outside. When Tape to Tape returns, we're going to talk to Josh Yeo and get the gold and black take. That's next on Tape to Tape.
For a guy to stand here and explain what he's gonna do different. I thought I left this in my office. What was the second? Oh, it was Braun. I'm sorry. Yeah. No, it didn't. I made those comments earlier in the week, but we didn't have a huge difference in opinion, I mean... Does somebody want to check this to make sure I didn't screw it up? Just you, Sam? Okay. Okay, sorry. Sorry.
Now the time has come. There are things to realize. Time has come today. Time has come today. Time.
Welcome back to Tape to Tape. Joining us on the line now, he covers the Penguins for DKPittsburghSports.com. It is Josh. Yo, Josh, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
We're doing all right. We were speaking in the first block of this show about some of the left turns that inevitably happen throughout a hockey season. And I have to say, if you go back to November, when Mike Johnson was still coaching this team, we were starting to kick around the possibility that, you know, maybe 6 months from then or 18 months from then, there might be some kind of Pittsburgh Penguins fire sale. Instead, here we are. They're in the Cup Final. We know the coaching change played a huge role in pushing this team forward, but what did you really see in the past, however many months now, 4 or 5 months, that just altered completely the outlook for this once middling Penguins team?
Well, it goes without saying that the coaching change was huge. Literally from the day Mike Sullivan took over, things just had a different feel around the Penguins, and he decided that for them to be successful, they needed to be a high-octane, aggressive, offensive puck possession team. And under Mike Johnson, frankly, they were sitting back and playing in a lot of 2-1 hockey games, and it's just not what they're built to do. And you're right, going back to November, they were a mess. Sidney Crosby was playing the worst hockey of his life. The Phil Kessel trade, you know, he wasn't playing horribly, but he wasn't really fitting in. It didn't look like it was a good move at the time. Just nothing was working. And when Mike Sullivan came on December 12th, everything changed. And you know, we've seen it before. The Penguins in 2009 were not dissimilar. They were out of the playoffs in February of that season when Mike Therrien was fired and Dan Bylsma replaced him. And all of a sudden, the magic happened. And it certainly seems like we've seen the same thing once again.
Now, could have all gone wrong after Marc-Andre Fleury got hurt. And you, I mean, Matt Murray has a great pedigree, but he was really unproven, especially in the playoffs. And he steps up and he's been awesome for the Penguins through this run. We've talked a number of times through this, through the playoffs here, about the dynamic between Murray and Fleury, and when would the Penguins go to Fleury and what situation would it take them to go. And then they did go to Fleury, and then they moved back to Murray. At this point, what has to happen in this final before the Penguins would make a switch back to Fleury? Is it a 2-0 deficit or a 3-0 deficit, or is it just stick with them and see what happens?
Well, I think the net is pretty much Murray's at this point. You know, if he goes out and has a couple of horrible games and the Penguins fall down 2-0, I guess it could happen. But the fact is, Marc-Andre Fleury wasn't particularly sharp in Game 5 against Tampa in the Eastern Conference Final, and the Penguins lost in overtime. And Matt Murray, you know, I don't know if I'd say he's been spectacular. He has been at times, but he's just solid as a rock every night. I've never seen a rookie goaltender with this kind of poise, and you hear it from his teammates on a regular basis. I've had 4 or 5 guys tell me that, you know, people don't think about this all that often, but when a goaltender is calm and seemingly in control, it just has a positive impact on the entire team, and they are just able to relax and play in front of him. As Sidney Crosby told me, you know, right when the playoffs were starting, he said, you know, we don't even really worry about Matt anymore. We know how good he is. And he, you know, he's just unflappable, and everybody has seen that. So the net is his. He would have to either get hurt or just implode, and I have seen no evidence to suggest that he's going to crumble on this stage.
Phil Kessel, we need to talk about him. We're based in Toronto here. He definitely had some battles with the media, I think unfairly. He was always a great player here in Toronto, and he's kind of run out of town, and now he's been leading the Penguins and scoring through this run. You know, probably their Conn Smythe favorite, or at least in the conversation there with Crosby. And what's he been like to cover with the Penguins?
Well, you know, I had some reservations when Phil came to Pittsburgh because, you know, we all know Phil's reputation. And here's what I've concluded about Phil. I don't think he's a bad guy at all. I really don't. I'd be lying to you if I told you that I know him really well now, because, you know, Phil doesn't let people in my position get to know him that well. I don't think he's a bad guy. I just think he's just very socially awkward and socially uncomfortable. He's not comfortable having 10 cameras in his face. He just isn't. Whereas Sidney Crosby can sit there all day and talk and it doesn't faze him, Phil's just wired a little differently. Phil just kind of wants to be left alone and to play hockey. And one thing I've learned about him, his teammates, at least I can't speak for Toronto because I don't know many of the guys that he played with there, but I can tell you on this Penguins team, his teammates legitimately like him. And they kind of get a kick out of him. They know he's awkward in the spotlight, and they have fun with it. That amuses them, but they genuinely like him. I've had many guys on this team during the season tell me that, you know, we heard stories about him, but he's actually not a bad guy at all. So, you know, Phil's not always perfectly behaved with the media. I'm sure some people in the Toronto media had every right to, you know, think some things about Phil that maybe weren't flattering. But I can tell you he's been really good to deal with here. He speaks to the media basically every day, which I know was not the case in Toronto. And everyone in the organization genuinely has a soft spot for the guy. And it's been kind of fun seeing him actually let his guard down a little bit. I'm sure you've noticed during this postseason, he's actually like smiling when he scores goals. And he looks like he's having the time of his life out there. So it's been kind of fun to watch.
If the Penguins do win the Cup, do you think Kessel is the first guy who gets handed the Cup from Crosby?
Well, you know, they might let Pascal Dupuy on the ice, and if that's the case, I don't know. That might be a pretty good choice, too, given what he's been through.
Yeah.
But if they, you know, who knows how that works. But if they would choose just out of those 20 guys, yeah, he probably would. I can tell you that, you know, his teammates, they feel like he's gotten a bad rap, and they're playing for him. They want to see him win. They love to see him. Mike Sullivan admitted it the other day. He said, you know, this is the playoffs. I don't have time to worry about emotions, but it's kind of nice seeing Phil with a smile on his face all the time. So, no, that would not shock me. And I don't know how that would go over in Toronto, but it would be quite a scene, wouldn't it?
Two guys he's associated with, because he skates on a line with them, Nick Bonino, Carl Hagelin, you know, they looked for where to slot Phil all year, and lo and behold, it was two, I think we could comfortably call them role players. They're not the only guys who've sort of risen up for this Penguins team. Tell us a little about some of the guys who aren't named Crosby, Malkin, Kessel, Letang, Matt Murray, who have really helped the Penguins get to where they are.
Well, one guy I go back to all the time is the fourth line center, Matt Cullen. What a hockey player this guy is. He scored 16 goals during the regular season. I think about half of them were game winners, or at least it felt that way. He's been even better in the playoffs. You know, he takes a lot of big face-offs. If somebody's hurt, he can slide up and play with Crosby and Malkin and be very effective. And the job he's done in the locker room. Penguins have a lot of rookies on this team. Tom Kunackle and Brian Rust and Connor Sheary, Matt Murray, all rookies. And they will tell you that Matt Cullen has played a huge role in their development. He's the guy that kind of puts his arm around them during the playoffs and shows them the way a little bit. So, you know, he's one guy to me that just jumps out. What an unbelievable signing from Jim Rutherford in August. Nobody thought much of it at the time, but he's made a real difference. And one other guy I will throw out there, you know about Letang and how gifted he is. Penguins have another young defenseman who's technically a rookie also named Brian Dumoulin. He has emerged as a legitimate top four player. He's a big kid, not real physical, but he can skate. He makes really good decisions with the puck, plays huge minutes now. He's playing with Letang. He has just been solid as a rock all season. We never knew he would be the big name maybe to emerge from the Jordan Staal trade a few years back when they got Derek Pouliot and Brandon Sutter back. But Dumoulin is the best player of those three guys right now.
I think it's fair to say Pittsburgh and San Jose match up very well. This should be a really good long series, but if there's a part of the Penguins lineup that you think might be a weakness against the Sharks, where they might lose this series, what would it be?
Well, a couple of things. The Penguins' power play is not as good as it should be. When you see Crosby, Malkin, Kessel, Letang, and Hornquist in front of the net, you think, how could they ever be stopped? But actually, it's not that great of a power play, and sometimes it saps energy away from them, so certainly would say the Sharks have a huge edge in that category in the power play. And also, just looking at the blue lines, I think the Sharks have more overall talent on their top four as opposed to the Penguins. You know about Letang, and I really like Dumoulin. Olimata and Ben Lovejoy as the second pairing, you know, they're not bad. They're solid players, but against those great Sharks forwards, maybe it's not the best matchup. And the Penguins wouldn't shock me if they start to miss Trevor Daley a little bit in this series. He was an awfully big part of this team all season.
When you talk about the Penguins, when you talk about the entire league, the name that's still at the top of the marquee is Sidney Crosby. When Pittsburgh won the Stanley Cup in 2009, as you know, has been said numerous times, we all thought that was the start of a run. Of course, they haven't been back to the final until now. If Sidney Crosby goes out there and leads Pittsburgh to its second Stanley Cup during his time there, do you think that is solidifying his legacy all time as you know, one of the bulletproof all time heavyweight players in the league?
I think it does. He's clearly, I think, the best player of his generation. The numbers back that up, both in terms of team accomplishment and an individual play. But when you consider, you know, he's, I think, still fifth or sixth all-time in points per game. If he gets that second Stanley Cup, most of the all-time greats get more than one. And we know that. If he gets the second one, to go with the two gold medals, including the golden goal, and just the excellence that he has displayed for a decade now, I think it probably solidifies him, I don't know, top 10 all-time maybe. I think that's fair. I mean, when he came into the league, he was, you know, always compared to Lemieux and Gretzky, and I don't think he's Lemieux and Gretzky. I don't really think it's fair to compare anyone to those two. I think they're the two best players ever. But I think if you look at the numbers he's produced in an era in which it's very difficult to score and to get that second cup, and if he has a really good final, I think in terms of his legacy, it does really do something, especially when you consider the playoff disappointments that he's endured the last few years. And he's aware of it, too. I mean, he really is. He just got that look on his face right now. You can see it. He's ready to go.
Well, a revved-up Sidney Crosby ready to kick off the Stanley Cup final. I don't think we could ask for anything better when it comes to the showcase series for the league. Josh Yeo will be there covering every second of it. For DKPittsburghSports.com. Josh, thanks for joining us today.
All right, always a pleasure. Thank you.
That is Josh O. You can follow Josh at Josh Yeo. That's Y-O-H-E underscore P-G-H. Follow him on the Twitter. That's the look from the Penguins corner. When we come back, we're going to examine the Sharks side of things. We're going to talk to Kevin Kurz, who is a Sharks insider for CSNBayArea.com. That's coming up next on Tape to Tape.
Fans here have waited so long, 25 years, and we've waited 18 years or so. So it's a great feeling, you know, being here my whole career and being around the city and the fans and all their support over the years. It's great to see. They deserve it just as much as we do, all the support they've been doing over the years.
Welcome back to Tape to Tape. You've heard the Penguins side of things. Now let's check in with the Sharks. Joining us on the line now, he is a Sharks insider for CSNBayArea.com. It's Kevin Kurz. Kevin, how you doing?
Good. How you doing?
We're doing all right. We're obviously more than a little amped up for what should be a great Stanley Cup final. Let's get right to it. Let's get to one of two unbelievable beards, but the only one who's been in the league for almost 20 years now. I mean, is there just a sense everywhere you go around this team that everyone is pulling for Joe Thornton to get that first championship and vanquish any question about how good or not good he is at the most critical time of year?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly the case in the Sharks dressing room. You know, they all love him in there. And, you know, I think that especially in recent weeks, we've seen kind of Joe's personality come out, you know, publicly, too. I think he was had a tendency to be kind of reserved. You know, last year he didn't really want to talk to the media a whole lot. And, you know, even this year, you know, he wouldn't say a whole lot, but I think he's kind of coming out of his shell now, because I think he realizes that, you know, the general feeling with Joe is that he has had a great career. He obviously hasn't won a Stanley Cup yet, but he's, you know, coming off of a great year this year, a year in which his name was mentioned as a Selke candidate, as a Hart candidate. You know, it didn't turn out that way. He didn't end up being a finalist, but this is a guy who had a heck of a year, and he's really, you know, still playing at such a high level. And now with the chance to win his first Stanley Cup, obviously it means a lot to him. And but again, I think it means a lot to the guys in the dressing room and his teammates that you know, really like and respect him.
I think what makes his storyline even more interesting is that after that loss to the Kings a couple of years ago, they wanted to change the leadership group in the room and maybe even move Thornton if, you know, he had just signed that new contract and wasn't going to be something that they could just trade away. He had the no trade clause and everything. And so they made the leadership group change. And yet here we are, Joe Thornton, like you said, amazing season, amazing playoffs. Everybody likes him in the room. But I mean, how much did that leadership group, like, how much did that change actually affect this team? Like, would they still be the team they are now if they didn't do that? Or, like, did it bring about a noticeable change in the room and in attitude or anything like that?
Yeah, that's one of those that's hard to answer. But, you know, I do think that, obviously, it starts with Joe Pavelski. And last season, which was, you know, a pretty brutal year and pretty dysfunctional year, really, for the team on a number of different levels. So they had the four rotating alternates. And Thornton was a part of that, but really it was Pavelski who kind of assumed all the captain's duties and was the guy that, you know, when they named him captain this year, we all of us around the team on a day-to-day basis expected it to be Pavelski, and would have been shocked if it was anybody but Pavelski, just because we saw that coming last year. So, you know, maybe that freed Joe up a little bit. Maybe he didn't feel as burdened, you know, to talk to the media guys every day and to wear that C and to carry some of the, you know, the weight that it brings. And conversely, you know, Pavelski thrived in that role. I think he embraced it. I think it was something that he wanted. I think it was something he deserved. And, you know, he's the guy that is the captain, and he really is the captain of this team, I think, in every sense. So, you know, when it comes to Thornton, again, maybe that freed him up. Maybe that helped him to, you know, focus more on the game and just going out and play. And, you know, we saw him have one of the best years of his career, frankly, this past year.
You mentioned all you guys who cover the team closely, who are around the Sharks on a day-to-day basis, know exactly how good Pavelski is. But do you get the sense that he's assumed that unofficial title as most underrated superstar in the NHL?
Yeah, it's funny. You hear, you know, when you hear that about Pavelski, you hear it a lot about Mark Edward Vlasic too. You know, a lot of people forget, I think, that Brent Burns is the focal point of the defense, but Mark Edward Vlasic is the guy that was on Team Canada's Olympic team, was named the World Cup roster as one of its first players. So, you know, Vlasic and Pavelski, obviously, I think, should be in that conversation too. You know, he's just one of the league's best goal scorers, and he matches up just as well with anybody. And his, you know, his ability to just deflect pucks in front of the net, it's not the sexiest way to score goals, let's face it. So he's not going to end up on too many highlight reels, but his ability to do that and just take a beating in front of the net and still find a way to get his stick on the puck or whack at a rebound is just, you know, he's as good as anybody in the league when it comes to that. So, yeah, you know, he's the guy that might be an underrated guy, but, you know, he's also played on a couple Olympic teams. You know, he's scoring 30 goals every year. So if people are considering him underrated, you know, maybe they just should watch the Sharks a little bit more, because everybody in San Jose, I think, knows his value to the team. And certainly the coaching staff and his teammates know that too.
We were talking to Josh Yeo from the Pittsburgh perspective of this series, and I asked him if there was a weakness for Pittsburgh that might lose in the series. He said Pittsburgh's power play doesn't match up to San Jose's, and their defense probably doesn't match up to the depth of San Jose's either. And I look at San Jose, and Martin Jones certainly has got to match up pretty well with Matt Murray. Their forward unit pretty much, I would think, matches up well with Pittsburgh's too. But if you think there's a weakness at somewhere in this Sharks lineup that might lose in the series, where Pittsburgh might hold an advantage that can win them the cup. Where is that weakness?
Yeah, you know, I would think it's on defense. I think, you know, you look at Trevor Daley, he's playing 22 minutes a night or so when he went out, and he was one of their best puck-moving defensemen. And I know some other guys came back in, you know, Ole Mata came back in and played well. But, you know, the Sharks, when they're on their game, they just come in waves. And, you know, a lot like Pittsburgh, when their offense is going, they're just going to keep coming at you with all those lines. But if the Sharks can get in and keep up that aggressive style on the forecheck, and you know, I think there are some there will be some chances for them there to take advantage of with some of these Pittsburgh defensemen. You know, whether it's Mata or Justin Schultz or Ian Cole or someone like that. You know, I think the opportunity is there for San Jose to do that. You know, conversely, I think Pittsburgh's offense, we've seen the way they can go. I look at the third lines, you know, we look at the Phil Kessel line, maybe going up against the Chris Tierney line. I think that's an advantage that Pittsburgh could potentially exploit. But at the same time, we thought going in the St. Louis series, the Blues were the deeper team offensively, especially after Pete DeBoer moved Patrick Marleau up to the second line. And really that didn't turn out to be the case. The Sharks matched them line for line, shift for shift, and they were the better team and they deserved to win. So, you know, I do think the Pittsburgh offense is certainly the best offense the Sharks will have seen so far in the playoffs, but we've also seen them shut down some pretty good players, whether it's Tarasenko or Tyler Toffoli or Philip Forsberg. You know, the leading goal scorers on the other team really haven't had much success against the Sharks, and that's a big part of that reason is guys like Vlasic, Braun, Martin Burns all playing very well and being at the top of their games.
The storyline in Pittsburgh is Crosby going for a second title, and I guess really trying to validate that team's status as, I mean, obviously we can't call them a dynasty, but as, you know, as a great core group that should win multiple championships and does if they can go ahead and do it. Obviously in San Jose, the long running narrative is they've had these great teams that just for whatever reason haven't been able to punch through, haven't even made the final. Now here they are. What's different, if you could put your finger on one or two things, that's allowed this Sharks team to get to where no other Sharks team from the past really decade has been able to get to?
I mean, it seems like an obvious answer, but it's the depth. And Joe Thornton has even mentioned that earlier in the season that he thought this was the deepest Sharks team that he's ever been on. And that goes back, you know, this is his 11th year with the team. So you look at the pieces they added in the offseason, Paul Martin, Joel Ward starts right there, upgrading their goaltending, moving on from Antti Niemi and finding Martin Jones and taking really a chance on Martin Jones, a pretty inexperienced guy, to come in and be the starter. That move worked out well. And then, you know, I think the fact that Pete DeBoer was obviously a new head coach, but he came in and it was evident right away, I think, that him and Doug Wilson were on the same page in terms of remaking the roster and finding the right guys. And you look at some of the midseason additions. Dinah Zubris was a guy that played for DeBoer in New Jersey, a guy he trusted. Came in, big body, gives him good minutes, serves as kind of a mentor to the bottom six forwards and some of the young guys they have down there. Nick Spaulding's come in and played admirably, at least on the fourth line. Roman Polak gave him some much-needed defensive depth, and those are all guys that can be traced back to DeBoer or Steve Spott, his assistant coach. So, you know, the fact that they have been able to improve the depth on this team, you look at some of the names that were on this team 2 years ago that lost to the Kings. You know, there's so many guys on that team that aren't even in the league anymore. You know, James Sheppard, Adam Burrish, Marty Havlat, guys that just did not get the job done when they were in here. And, you know, subsequently they're not in the league anymore, like I said. So I think the fact that they do have those guys that they brought in, Jonas Donskoy, a rookie, turned out to be a gem that Doug Wilson was able to kind of find there. So, that's where it starts. But, you know, it's the depth. And again, like I mentioned, the goaltending, I think some Sharks playoff runs in the past, we've seen the goalies let in some goals at inopportune times, whether that was Niemi, whether that was Evgeny Nabokov. And with Martin Jones, that just hasn't happened. When he's had bad games or let in a bad goal, he just doesn't let it affect him. He moves on and he usually responds the right way. And, you know, Sharks are 5-1 coming off of a loss in the playoffs so far. And Martin Jones has been one of the biggest reasons for that.
San Jose is the last California team to not win a cup. And it sounds like, and I hear a lot of people say it, like they might have the best fan base out of all those California teams. A lot of people I hear say that arena is one of the best in the NHL. It certainly comes across that way on television. It sounds very, very loud in there. What is the feeling in and around the arena with the fans and everybody in that city now that they finally got to this Stanley Cup final and they're four wins away from winning it all?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are starting to come back. You know, frankly, the 2014 playoff collapse hurt them. And this season especially, you know, then they go and miss the playoffs. And then this season especially, we saw some empty seats and they had trouble selling out the building. And they even had trouble selling out some playoff games. So, you know, the fact that they have finally gotten this far, I think a lot of people in the Bay Area are realizing that, you know, this team is still pretty good. Obviously, they can win a Stanley Cup championship. But there was, you know, it was a long road, I'd say, after that playoff collapse of the Kings. That was the last straw, I think, for a lot of people, for at least a little while. And you know, not to mention they're still competing with the Golden State Warriors and what they've done and, you know, their championship season and their season this year. So I think a lot of the casual fans migrated a little bit to the Warriors, but it was an important year for the Sharks. You know, they're coming off of that playoffless season, still the same core guys. You know, the reputation with the Sharks nationally is still a little bit of the case locally. You know, good teams, just never quite good enough. You know, I think now they're realizing that this team might be the one that just that is good enough.
Well, they've done impeccable work to get to the final. We'll see if they can finish the job. A lot of people, I think a lot of neutrals are probably rooting a little bit for San Jose because of the Big Joe factor. However it goes down, we know Kevin Kurz will be there detailing every shift. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem, guys. Take care.
That is Kevin Kurz, a San Jose Sharks insider for CSNBayArea.com. You can follow Kevin on Twitter at KKurz, KURZCSN. Well, Rory, we've heard the Sharks take. We've heard the Pens take from the guys on the ground. Anyone who's been listening to the show knows you had San Jose, Washington in the final. I had St. Louis, Washington. So I guess we both, well, I feel like in this day and age, if you can put one team in the final when it's, you know, mm-hmm. as close as it is, that's pretty impressive. So kudos to you for being able to nail one of them. We know you're not veering from your pick now. So no. Tell us why you think San Jose will beat Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I'm obviously sticking with San Jose, but I'm not just sticking with them because I picked them. I'm feeling very confident about this pick, and if I was a neutral observer, I would still be picking San Jose because they don't seem to have a weakness. They don't seem to have, even when Kevin was talking there, I mean, he's saying Pittsburgh might be able to take advantage of San Jose on the third line. I don't think that's going to be what wins a series for Pittsburgh in seven games. I feel very confident. San Jose's power play has rolled over everybody. Their depth has rolled over everybody. Martin Jones has been solid. This is a weird Stanley Cup final for goalies because neither of them have any experience here. And I'm trying to think of another situation where that might be comparable to this. And the only one I can maybe think of is the Chicago-Philadelphia series from a few years back where it was Antti Niemi for the Hawks. And I think it was Michael Layton for Philadelphia that didn't really have any experience. I think it's a little different, though, because I think these goalies are both better than those guys will, you know,
see
ever
Stanley
be.
Cup final winning goal.
Yeah, but I think I'm still going to make some kind of a wild prediction here. I think it will qualify as a wild prediction. I think San Jose is going to have an easier time with Pittsburgh than a lot of people think, and I think it's going to be five games.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I just think they match up too well against them in many different areas.
You know what? I mean, I know we heard Josh Yeo singing the praises of Brian Dumoulin, and I don't know. I just keep looking at the Pittsburgh D. Granted, I said this, I think, in rounds one, two, and three, but, you know, you just think of that combined with, as you mentioned, the depth of San Jose. It is tough to imagine that at some point San Jose isn't going to really be able to flex some dominance with that. But I think I'm... I have to go to at least six games. And you know what? Maybe even the distance because of Pittsburgh's forwards. I guess I'll stick with the chicken pick and go with six. I feel like that's the default. But yeah, I think, I mean, and just, it just always, I mean, I know Pittsburgh beat a very plucky Tampa team, savvy Tampa team, great Washington team. But man, you make it through the Western. You beat the Kings, you beat the Blues. Like,
and you look very good doing it.
Yeah,
too.
Absolutely.
You never felt like the Kings or the Blues were going to win those series.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kings easily. I mean, the Blues, even though they were tied 2-2 in that series, I mean, San Jose was overwhelming them all along. You never felt like they were going to really lose unless they sharked and
melted
down like they always do. And they didn't. They didn't do it. They've shown no signs of that this year.
All right. Well, two guys who are swimming with the Sharks here. We'll see how it plays out. Very exciting as always. Well, not as always. Sometimes you get matchups that aren't that exciting, but I think, I mean, even if you, as you mentioned, you think it might be a short series, you still got Sidney Crosby and Big Joe going. It's really should be a lot of fun. You know, you can count on T2T to be chronicling how things are going. We figured to check in, hopefully, maybe about halfway through the series. We'll see how things are going next week. You also must know by now you can find us on iTunes where you can subscribe. You can check us out on sportsnet.ca. It's been an exciting time through the playoffs, man. It is the best time of the year, and now we're right in the heart of it. So enjoy it, hockey fans. And make sure you tune in next time for more Glass Rattlin' hockey action on Tape to Tape.
This has been Tape to Tape, the hockey podcast by Sportsnet. It gets so sticky down here.